According to the Bible, Jesus Christ was circumcised on the eighth day after his birth. Until 1960, the Catholic Church celebrated this day as Circumcision Day, and in medieval times, the holy foreskin was worshipped in many European churches. According to the Gospel of Luke, chapter 2, it says, quote, "And when 8 days were fulfilled to circumcise the child, his name was called Jesus, the name called by the angel before he was conceived in the womb." The circumcision of Christ became a very common subject in Christian art from the 10th century onwards, one of numerous events in the life of Christ to be frequently depicted by artists. The circumcision controversy in early Christianity was resolved in the first century so that non-Jewish Christians were not obligated to be circumcised. Circumcision soon became rare in most of the Christian world, except the Coptic Church of Egypt, where circumcision was a tradition dating to pre-Christian times. Most rabbis, imams, and biblical scholars trace circumcision to an alleged covenant made between God and Abraham, as put forth in the book of Genesis. However, a bas relief on an Egyptian sarcophagus predating the accepted birth of Abraham shows male circumcision being practiced as a ritual prior to entry into the priesthood. According to mainstream academia, exactly when and why this practice started is debatable, but most anthropologists agree that its origin predates written history. That said, Christopher Columbus reported circumcision being practiced by Native Americans, and while this prompted many people to conclude that they were amongst the lost tribes of Israel, which may or may not be the case, I would argue against an old world origin, since the Aztec, Maya, and even Inca also practiced a modified form of circumcision. In the case of the New World, the procedure was not exactly the same as practiced by modern Abrahamic faiths, as the rituals seemed to stem around bloodletting from the genitals performed upon the sons of what were described as, quote, great men, rather than complete removal of foreskin, although the very tip may have been removed. Although the Inca are considered a technologically sophisticated culture that assembled the largest empire in the Western Hemisphere, they were the only major Bronze Age civilization that failed to develop a system of writing, so data concerning their rituals remain largely speculative. That said, the Inca seem to have arose from a prior South American culture which they conquered and may have adopted rituals from, which would explain this puzzling shortcoming, which modern academia nowadays calls the Inca paradox. Circumcision has also traditionally been found among Samoan and other Pacific Island cultures, which is associated with a rite of passage, sign of manliness, and sexual prowess. These pro-sexual reasons seem to be counterintuitive, since the surgical procedure removes highly sensitive skin, which many people conclude may in fact reduce sensitivity, which may be a clue to the origin of this practice and its link to a priestly class. In antiquity, pre-Abrahamic faiths were closely tied to phallic symbolism. Fertility cults were common throughout Europe in pre-Christian times, with hundreds of stone phalluses having been found in Norway alone. They're symbolic representations of the male member, representing male potency, fertility, as well as spirituality. While many Jews, Christians, and Muslims will likely reject the link between sex and spirituality, one needs only to look at the story of Adam and Eve in Genesis, which, according to the Zohar, is not about a literal talking snake and an apple, but the forbidden fruit represents the orgasm, and the serpent represents the lightbringer and the forces of enlightenment, in the context of Prometheus, also a lightbearer and savior of mankind in Greek mythology. another story from Greek mythology, which, according to Plato, has its origins in Egyptian history, is the legend of Atlantis, which is about an ancient seafaring civilization that attacked the Mediterranean at the end of the Pleistocene. According to Plato, this empire came from the Atlantic and attempted to enslave the people of the Mediterranean, but ultimately failed before being subdued by massive cataclysms which ended the Ice Age. According to honorary 33rd degree Freemason Manly P. Hall, Atlantis may have been the original source for carnal practices, which he referred to as black magic.
The princes of the islands of the Atlantides became very proud. They decided that they would conquer the world. So in order to achieve this great end, they decided to send expeditions of conquest over all the other parts of the then Atlantean distribution. These peoples possessed extrasensory perceptions that had not yet been closed by the process of embodiment. They were like the extrasensory perceptions of small children, in whom faculties are partly active, which are now dormant in our racial groups. So in any way, these magicians, these sorcerers, these powerful ones who possessed Brill being the one motive power that is inexhaustible, something we could use today, that we'd carry anything, transport anything, activate anything that the human being could conceive. And so in their pride, these princes decided near the end of their time to invade what is now Europe. They decided to invade in the areas of the Mediterranean, North Africa, and the Near East. So they sent great fleets to conquer these countries. Everywhere the sea was the source of instruction. Something came from the sea. We can't dogmatize what it is, but it is interesting that at a remote period, certainly 8 or 10,000 years ago, if not more, doctrines and concepts and beliefs reached all parts of the world and are still reserved and preserved in all the mythologies, legends, and allegories of ancient peoples and were recognized as the ultimate source of civilization. But in any event, far back, there were forms of life and culture very different from what we have today, which destroyed themselves by the misuse of the spiritual powers of life. That these people who are said to have come and brought all the secrets of life to these primitive peoples could have been the citizens of the great Atlantic Empire, the empire that was far higher and far more advanced in many ways even than we are today. Their civilization was different. They were not bound tremendously to an industrial program. They didn't need it, and we wouldn't need it if we developed the resources within ourselves. The idea that we have to run the planet the way we're running it now simply means that we do not recognize that within ourselves are the answers to the questions that we now find so difficult. That actually, if we use the interior potential we have, we would have no need of all the problems of depressions and all the mysteries of exploitation that we suffer from today. So, in that type of thinking, we might also find a source for much of our religious thinking. These mysterious priests of the serpent of the city of the sun. These priests were undoubtedly wise in the mysteries of life. The ancient rites and mysteries of the Greeks and Romans and Egyptians, the secret and esoteric teachings that have descended to us from unknown antiquity, may very well have originated among the esotericists of Atlantis. we have some suspicion that many of the civilizations of the Near East, and perhaps even of the Far East, originated among these transplanted peoples who had gone away from the cause of death. It is stated in the Atlantic story that a great number of the gods of Egypt were, we'll say, refugees from Atlantis. That the gods of the Egyptians were Atlantean deities who originally, perhaps, actually and physically lived as leaders of their peoples. In any event, the idea that the world was populated, in one sense, by refugees is not unreasonable. Another story of the same type, which is found in many parts of the world, states that the Atlanteans earned their final destruction by an attempt to invade Europe, that they raised a great army and sent it against Europe and North Africa. And this great army was on the march and was in these areas, claiming them, when the Central Islands were destroyed. Therefore, these armies could not return. There was no place to go back to. And many of them settled and mingled with the peoples of these areas to form some of these wonderful and mysterious civilizations which we have no real explanation for. We have very little explanation for how racial differentiation in recent times came about. Various anthropologists and so forth have charts showing what happened. But as is the case in most of science, no one seems to know how it happened or why it happened. These things occurred. New blood streams came forth, mingled and mixed and intertwined, and each one brought with it part of its own culture. And these parts of ancient cultures seem to linger on, perhaps in lingual differences, in arts and crafts, in psychological structures, in habits and principles, and even to a measure in bodily form and structure. Is it true that a civilization existed long ago which knew what we do not know today? Is there something lost in our way of life because it disappeared under the waters of the Atlantic so far back in our story? Is it true that there were giants upon the earth in those days, mental giants, that had skills and abilities which they had derived from the studies of esoteric matters? Did black magic originate in Atlantis? It probably did, according to the Platonic discussion, because it was in Atlantis that for the first time man disobeyed the gods. And from disobedience fell the angels. The entire story of human progress, so-called, is today very largely a record of disobedience. The individual has broken the rules of life. Some people, having broken the rules of life, try to study esoteric matters, hoping to find the secrets of some strange magic of long ago. There are records and legends and accounts everywhere of secret teachings, esoteric schools. There are accounts of ways by which the human being can develop faculties and powers at present beyond his capacity.
Honorary 33rd degree Freemason Manly P. Hall, who literally wrote the book on the occult, stated that black magic likely started in Atlantis, and that some of the Atlanteans probably survived the cataclysms that ended the Pleistocene to settle on both sides of the Atlantic. All forms of magic, regardless of intent, involves the harnessing and transmutation of sex energy, which is the true esoteric purpose for circumcision, which allegedly aids the practitioner in occult tantric practices, the idea being to redirect one's life force energy without prematurely expelling it via climax. If there's any truth to an Atlantean source of occult practices stretching back into prehistory, then we can revisit the topic of my last upload called Origin of the Sea People, where I made the case for the Sea People being Atlantean refugees who also unsuccessfully invaded the Mediterranean several times during the Holocene. Of course, many of the Sea People went on to settle parts of the Americas and the Mediterranean, mixing in with what are generically known as Phoenicians, among others, but many were also enslaved by the Egyptians, as depicted on the great Karnak inscription of the pharaoh Merenptah, stating that at least three of the Sea Peoples, the Ekwesh, the Sheklesh, and the Sherdin, were circumcised. That said, the next major event in the Egyptian saga involves an exodus of circumcised slaves out of Egypt, and the rest, as they say, is history. Most people are familiar with the story of Moses leading captive slaves out of Egypt, eventually settling in what is now modern Israel. The other name for this part of the Levant is called Palestine, which gets its name from the Philistines, also thought to be one of the Sea People. One of the 12 tribes that comprised what are known today as Israelites was the tribe of Dan, who were symbolically represented by the serpent and the color red. The most famous Philistine was Goliath, known for his giant stature, and the most famous Danite was Samson, known for his supernatural strength. The biblical account states that Samson was a Nazarite, one who has taken a voluntary vow of celibacy, abstains from alcohol, or at least grapes, and may not cut his hair, which is a sign of chastity, and the source of his immense strength and virility, which allowed him to perform superhuman feats, including slaying a lion with his bare hands. His legendary power was drained from him when his hair was symbolically cut by Delilah, who was also a Philistine, and is often depicted nude in bed with Samson, because the cutting of his hair represents the carnal act which weakened Samson's vril, or life force energy. Nazarite comes from the Hebrew word nazar, meaning sacred, set apart, or separated. In other words, to abstain from, as in chastity. John the Baptist was also a Nazarite, and regardless of tribe, any Jewish person could become a Nazarite by an intentional verbal declaration, including children. Of course, Jesus himself is traditionally depicted with long hair, and usually with a beard, as many believe that he was a member of the Essenes, a Gnostic sect which also partook in vows of chastity, meaning they participated in esoteric tantra and transmuted their sex energy into refined spiritual energy. The term Jesus of Nazareth is almost universally accepted in mainstream Christianity as having to do with a town called Nazareth, which is not mentioned once in the Old Testament or in rabbinic literature, but sects of esoteric Christianity argue that Jesus, like John the Baptist, took the Nazarite vow. Samuel Einweyer is a proponent of this perspective and argues in his book, The Perfect Matrimony, The Door to Enter into Initiation, quote, "Sexual magic is practiced in esoteric Christianity. Sexual magic is practiced in Zen Buddhism. Sexual magic is practiced amongst the initiated yogis. Sexual magic is practiced amongst the Muslim Sufis. Sexual magic was practiced in the initiate colleges of Troy, Egypt, Rome, Carthage, Eleusis. Sexual magic was practiced by the mysterious Maya, Aztec, Inca, Druids, etc." Thank you. esoteric Christianity represents the unveiled teachings of the mysteries of the gospel normally concealed to the public. In 200 AD, Saint Clement of Alexandria wrote in his book, The Stromata, quote, "The mysteries of the faith are not to be divulged to all. It is requisite to hide in a mystery the wisdom spoken, which the Son of God taught." Saint Clement, also known as Clement of Alexandria, was a Christian theologian and philosopher, familiar with the classical Greek philosophy and literature, as well as pre-Christian Jewish esotericism and Gnosticism. In one of his works, he argued that Greek philosophy had its origin among non-Greeks, claiming that both Plato and Pythagoras were taught by Egyptian scholars. According to Saint Clement, who is regarded as a church father, there are mysteries within the Christian doctrine, and they are not normally exposed unless you've had some type of special teaching. We can find this sentiment mirrored in the New Testament itself in Matthew 13, quote, "And the disciples came and said to him, Why do you speak to them in parables? He answered and said to them, Because it has been given to you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been given." Many people seem to think that these mysteries are exposed by simply reading the Bible, but the word mystery means something of which initiation is necessary, a secret doctrine. In other words, no matter how high your IQ is, you can't just figure it out unless it's explained to you by someone that knows the esoteric content. The word esoteric has the root eso, which means interior or within. Esoteric, coming from the Greek word esoterikos, means intended to be revealed only to the initiated of a group, understood or meant for only the select who have special knowledge or interest, belonging to the select few. While this degree of secrecy might strike some as being deceptive, the idea was, at least in antiquity, that during this time, it was very important to withhold the esoteric doctrine from those not yet ready for it, and instead to give them a teaching that would help to prepare them. And for those that were prepared, the inner esoteric doctrine was revealed. The very nature of the Bible and many other ancient scriptures is that both of these teachings are within the same books, within the same scriptures. As Jesus stated, those that have ears to hear it and eyes to see it, they see the level of teaching that they can comprehend. As Saint Paul states, some are not yet ready for the meat. They are not ready for the solid food. They are ready for the milk. Quote, "And I, brethren, could not speak to you as to spiritual people, but as to carnal, as to babes in Christ. I fed you with milk and not with meat. For until now you are not able to receive it, and even now you are still not able." So, this is the way it has been for a long time. Unfortunately, the modern forms of Christianity, Islam, and Judaism that are popular and prevalent deny an esoteric aspect to the symbolism which they interpret at face value. Just as the Zohar stated, what happens is that they inherit only the cloak, the veneer, the outer dress of the teachings, which are good but only for a certain level. They have lost the inner doctrine, the esoteric form of Christianity. If you literally read the Bible, you'll find all sorts of contradictions. For someone who critically analyzes that, if there's no inner teaching, all that can be seen is something that contradicts itself or something that appears superficial. This is the main reason why many people have left their traditional religion, because they can only find the lower level, the milk, and they're ready to receive the meat. That said, while there may have once been legitimate reasons to have an inner doctrine, veiled from the general public and from power structures that employed corporal punishment, times have changed, and in the modern age of information, I believe it's important to properly interpret and disseminate the occult information, because not everybody that claims to possess the inner teachings legitimately has them, and those that do have exploited this knowledge to further a political agenda and not a spiritual one. In traditional forms of Christianity, because Jesus died on the cross, all of our sins are washed away, and all that is required is faith, or good works based upon faith, for the removal of our guilt, making the sinner righteous again. This is viewed in the exoteric way, as a historical fact. From an inner or esoteric perspective, while the events 2,000 years ago attributed to Jesus are still revered, all of this must be understood as something happening within the individual and relevant today. Those events of the New Testament are pointing towards spiritual realities that must occur within ourselves. All of the characters of the Bible are related to certain aspects of ourselves. So, from an esoteric perspective, what is meant by the world is our own inner world. Esoteric Christianity views the soul as something that must be worked on, must be developed, and that effort other than faith alone is necessary for spiritual salvation. Unlike the traditional forms of Abrahamic religions, it is understood in the esoteric or Gnostic forms that we can know and experience God directly. This is one of the main differences. The church, synagogue, or mosque as a middleman is not necessary, as even a beach can be one's temple. Gnosis is the Greek word for knowledge, and the idea that there's a spark of divinity within us that can provide us with knowledge of the divine. This is something that many ancient church fathers also agreed with. Justin Martyr was an early Christian philosopher who lived during the 2nd century AD. The First Apology, his most well-known text, passionately defends the morality of the Christian life and provides various ethical and philosophical arguments to convince the Roman Emperor to abandon the persecution of the church. Quote, "And when we say that he, Jesus Christ, our teacher, was crucified and died and rose again and ascended into the heaven, we propound nothing different from what you believe regarding those whom you esteem sons of Jupiter." He also indicates, as St. Augustine would later, that the true religion, or, quote, "seeds of Christianity," actually predated Christ's incarnation. He was referring to what the Greeks called gnosis and the Kabbalists called light. In The Perfect Matrimony, Samuel Einweiler said, "The sexual impulse is an illuminating factor. It is always a type of light. If you expel the light, you are full of darkness. People think after the orgasm that now that agitation is gone, so one feels relaxed again. But that's not really what's happening. This is like a person walking into a room. They turn the lights on, and they see something horrific. They get scared, and then they turn off the lights, and they think, oh, everything is better. Actually, everything is the same, just there's no light to see. Every time you orgasm, you're turning the lights off. Then, little by little, the energy accumulates again. The orgasm is a great exchange of temporary sensations for long-term ignorance, darkness, and desire. We also mistake that the sensation of dullness is happiness. The more you begin to transform your sexual energy and try to eliminate your desires, the more that light of your transformed sexual impulse is going to illuminate deeper factors within yourself. You're going to continue to see more and more things within your mind. Every time you spill the energy, you're removing the ability for you to connect very powerfully with God. The transformation of our sexual impulse is the very connection. This is the very type of energy that allows us to receive and send the information between us as soul and spirit. Our energy is like a fluidic transceiver, like an antenna that is made out of fluid, And that fluid is all of our nervous energies. Not nervous as in anxious, but as in our nervous system. When you transmute sexual energy, your whole body becomes an antenna for receiving the signals, for receiving the beauty of the world. Then you are tapped into a limitless, universal nature of compassion. When you are tapped into that, the small types of trivial things do not upset us so much, and we find a wellspring of happiness, of joy, of beauty, of knowledge coming from within ourselves. The doctrine of sexual transmutation is at the very essence, the very core, the very beginning of esoteric Christianity. Matthew 19 talks about eunuchs, but this needs to be understood symbolically. But he said unto them, all men cannot receive this saying, only they to whom it is given. For there are eunuchs who were born from their mother's womb, and there are some eunuchs who were made eunuchs of men, and there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. He that is able to receive it, let him receive it. The context of this verse is about energy transmutation, not literal castration. To not only use the energy to procreate, and instead use the energy for developing the soul. Of course, the esoteric doctrine has never been for everybody, but there are those that believe that everybody has the right and the capacity to walk this path if they choose to, and at the very least, be exposed to it academically. The topic of being born again is one of the more popular, prevalent phrases in modern Christianity, which often has something to do with baptism. For those interested in the esoteric interpretation of this concept, I will leave a link in the description to a presentation I did called Secrets of Gnostic Baptism. Also, make sure to subscribe for future videos on this topic, which I will be covering again soon in much more detail. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon and through all other major book outlets. If you'd like to support my work, you can do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description. Please subscribe for future updates. Leave your thoughts below. Have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.